Inside Virgin Galactic Spaceship 2, this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. Let's head for California's Mojave Desert and the busy hangar where Virgin Spaceship Unity is getting ready to rocket into space. Bill Nye is marking a significant achievement in efforts to protect humanity from spaceborne Armageddon. On our weekly What's Up segment, Bruce Betts will mark what would have been Carl Sagan's 82nd birthday, just before we present another space trivia contest. We begin, as we should, by visiting with the Planetary Society's senior editor, Emily Lakdawalla. Emily, we're a bit late getting to it, but still plenty to look forward to in this month in your What's Up in the Solar System for November of 2016. Let's start with Cassini, which you say is having a big, big month.
It really is. Cassini is now circling Saturn. To me, it feels a bit like circling the drain, but we're not quite there yet. But it is going around really fast, like once every 8 or 9 days. It's fast for Cassini because that means it's quite close to Saturn. And the reason they've got so close is because they are just about at the end of the month to do this major Titan flyby that will abruptly shift its periapsis, the closest point to Saturn on its orbit, way closer to Saturn than it's been before. They're actually, right now, the periapsis is close to Titan. They're going to jump over all the rings, the E and G rings, to right outside the F ring, which is right outside the main ring system. So they're going to be going in between the G and F rings for 20 orbits. It's going to be fabulous close-up views of Saturn's rings and a whole new phase of the mission.
Very exciting stuff. How about jumping one planet inward to Juno, circling Jupiter?
Yeah, so the news from Juno is not quite as good. They had to skip their orbit burn to shorten their orbit to 2 weeks, and they also didn't get to do science in the last periapsis. And it now sounds like they're going to stay in this long 53.5-day orbit for quite some time while they try to figure out what's going on with their thruster system. Mm. Now, Juno can still keep doing science on each periapsis. It's just that the science is going to happen a lot slower. To me, the most unfortunate thing about it is that with Cassini going into this special orbit that's very close to the planet, Cassini's orbit and Juno's orbit were going to look very much the same at the same time, and they were going to be able to do the same kind of science at two giant planets with the same sun having the same activity at the same time. And the longer that Juno stays in this really long orbit, the less overlap the two great missions get studying the giant planets in the same way. So that's a little bit sad.
That's a shame, yeah, but still both doing good science. And finally, from our colleague Jason Davis, the Long March 5, a big rocket, made it out of China.
Yes, and that is a really big deal. That rocket is as powerful as a Delta IV Heavy. It will be able to get China to its lunar sample return plans and eventually to launch big components for space stations. So that's an important milestone for the Chinese space program.
And should anybody be curious about where everything is in the solar system, you've once again included that updated map from Olaf Frun, is it?
It's close enough.
All right. Anyway, it is in the November 1st update from Emily. And there's another post just about Juno that has an update to that Marble movie as the spacecraft approaches the king of planets in our solar system. Thank you, Emily.
Thank you, Matt.
She is our senior editor and planetary evangelist for the Planetary Society, also a contributing editor to Sky and Telescope magazine. The boss, the CEO of the Planetary Society, is Bill Nye, the science guy. Bill, we note this week that NASA announces that it has reached a milestone of sorts, a kilometer marker.
Yeah, we love kilometer markers, but in this case, we need 15,000 of them. We believe we found the 15,000th asteroid that's near the Earth. This is the kind of thing that is important because of what we discovered about the ancient dinosaurs. You do not want to get hit by an asteroid, even a small one.
It certainly indicates a lot of progress, and this includes even fairly small asteroids, ones that might not even make it down to the surface, plus those planet-killing ones.
Yeah, well, I like to think of them as city-killing, county-killing, country-killing, continent-killing, and then everything that you've ever known killing asteroids. So they're important to find. As we like to joke, there is no evidence that the ancient dinosaurs had a space program. And so So if they did, they were unsuccessful. But we could be the first generation of people that is ready to deflect one of these things. And the key is to find it early. And by early, they mean 20 years. 20 years before it would not only cross the Earth's orbit, but hit the Earth. So it's a very important work. It's not something you you stop doing everything else and address. It's something that you as a civilization just constantly work on, constantly keep it going, as counting asteroids, determining their orbital paths, and in the kind of getting ready with a big rocket to go out there, give it a nudge, give it a little nudge.
Clearly, FEMA and NASA are taking this seriously because they're practicing for the worst.
Yeah. They're really revving it up to be ready to evacuate people from a small, let's call it a city-sized killer. What did you call it? A city killer asteroid. Yeah. That would be really good to be ready for something like that. Even better would be ready to deflect it, give it a nudge.
Well, we need that 20-year warning that you were talking about.
Yeah, that's right. And we can do it, though. Finding the 15,000th one is significant. It means the effort's going along. It's something that we should all be proud of. It's a good use of our unelected treasure.
And something that is central to the Planetary Society mission.
Oh, yes, it is indeed. Thank you, Matt.
You're welcome. Thank you, Bill.
Let's change the world.
He's Bill Nye, the CEO of the Planetary Society. Bill Nye, the science guy, that is. On now to the Mojave Desert and me getting to stick my head inside Spaceship Two. Yeah, it was thrilling.
Wow, really?
Yep. The Mojave Desert is where scores of experimental aircraft have taken flight, a few spacecraft too, including the Space Shuttle. Out on a corner of the Mojave Air and Spaceport is a nearly new hangar that belongs to the Spaceship Company, the now wholly owned division of Virgin Galactic, charged with building and testing the White Knight II motherships that will take Spaceship Two rocket planes to their launch altitude of about 15,000 meters or 50,000 feet. From there, Spaceship Two will carry its pilots and astronaut clients beyond the edge of space. I parked in front of the huge and poetically named facility in early October. I am in the reception area of Faith that belongs to the Spaceship Company with one of the guys in charge here, Enrico Palermo, who is the executive VP and general manager. Did I get that right?
Yeah, welcome, Matt. Welcome to Faith. So Faith is really our home for the Spaceship Company operations here in Mojave. It stands for Final Assembly, Integration and Test Hangar. And based on that name, you can kind of guess what we're going to see when we head out to the shop floor.
And I can't wait. I'm thrilled. It's been a good long while. One of the better acronyms, though, NASA should be taking acronym training from you guys.
Yeah, maybe. Well, we're not great. There are a couple of other buildings are like Building 79, Building 4, so we need to up our game on some of our other buildings.
Yeah, but this is where a lot of the magic happens.
It is. This is where we rolled out Spaceship early this year, and it's where we're conducting flight tests from.
Lead on. Oh, my God.
Yeah, we call this the S corridor. You come out and you see both vehicles. So to our right is Virgin Mothership Eve, the launch vehicle, which I think you've seen in the past, Matt, and then Virgin Spaceship Unity. This is the spaceship that is in flight test now. We started last month. The first vehicle that the Spaceship Company has built and assembled.
All right, I'm waiting for my goosebumps to go down.
It's pretty neat. And yeah, let's go for a walk and have a look. We have restarted tours for our future astronauts from around the world. And so we take Polaroid photos of them and put them on a map of the world. And then it's a nice connection. It reminds our team that we are building the spaceships for these remarkable individuals. About 700 from around the world, 58 countries have signed up to fly on Spaceship Two.
I've met a lot of these people. And other than being incredibly envious of them, I'm so impressed with their enthusiasm. They can't wait.
Yeah, they are part of our program. They're not just a customer. Many have signed up because they realize what is happening in at VG and TSC and New Space generally is this interesting pivot, I think, in humanity's history, and they really want to be at the start of it.
So they've signed their Polaroids here, and I'm just looking at the one from Carl that says, I'm probably going naked. I don't know if that'll be against VG rules.
Yeah, that's typical of astronaut Carl. It would be against current rules, but you never know.
So are we going any further than this?
Yeah, we're going to go further. Let's go check with the crew chief.
Okay.
Can we go around the front of White Knight 2? Great.
So. Thank you.
Yeah. You've seen White Knight 2 before, but we took delivery of Eve, which is the name of this first mothership after Rich's mother, from Scale Composites. We've been operating it for a couple of years now. Really, we just continue to evolve it. This is our first stage that has flown over 210 times in various missions, so we continue to optimize it for commercial service. Right now, we're just doing some inspections and preparing it for the next flight.
There is a woman up there, right above the center of this beautiful aircraft, who's got her head halfway down into sort of the cowl there.
Yeah, that's right. That is Courtney. Courtney's one of our AMP mechanics on the Virgin Galactic Ops team. And yeah, we're doing, I think, three flight inspections that are part of the sort of preventative maintenance plan on the vehicle.
You look at an aircraft like this, and if you're into aviation at all, you think Burt Rutan. Mm-hmm. So we have a pretty cool office at the Planetary Society, a lot of cool space props. We don't have any winged spacecraft.
Yeah, exactly. I actually sit on the shop floor, so the desk you look at, myself and the president, Doug Shane, of the spaceship company, we're on the shop floor. And yeah, rather than sit in an office, I pull my head up and there's a spaceship there, so it's pretty neat.
And this is the new model. I mean, we're not talking about the grand old companies of aerospace where, I mean, I've been through it. You have to go through a whole bunch of layers to get up to the people at your level, Doug Shane's level.
Yeah, that's right. Very approachable. Doug has a good joke that we abandoned our open door policy. We got rid of the walls. So it works out well. It means we can have anyone can come to us at any time and chat and vice versa. All right, let's go look at Unity. So Unity is our pride and joy. So we unveiled her to the world in February this year. It was in this hangar. So if you've seen footage from that,
wish I'd been here.
You wouldn't believe it. Yeah, it was. I was fortunate enough to be towing the Land Rover with Richard next to me, sort of waving to the crowds. So that was a real buzz. And the vehicle's in essentially modification for the next flight. So the next flight is intended to be a glide flight. You can see the vehicle. It actually came on a good day, Matt.
I'm sorry. Let me stop you. Yes. A glide. You're going to release
that's
Unity next time?
Yep, that's the plan. So Unless, you know, the first captive carry flight was very successful. It was a long flight, 3 hours 45, and So we had a very detailed test card. But, you know, we haven't gone through final flight readiness reviews. That's the plan for the next flight. But you've arrived on a unique day. The vehicle's feathered, so you can actually see what the vehicle looks like in its feathered configuration for re-entry. And so this is a remarkable vehicle that, you know, flies at 2 to 3 times the speed of sound, but also, you know, has to fold in half as part of its re-entry into the atmosphere.
And I remember hearing Burt Rutan talk about how this came to him. He like sat up in bed one night and realized, hey, this is a way to get stuff back from space without overcomplicating things. Could you just describe, I mean, most of our audience probably knows what we're looking at right now, but just in case.
Yeah, it was certainly sort of a eureka moment. So traditionally there's been two ways to re-enter the Earth's atmosphere, and re-entry is typically one of the riskier parts of it's either that or launch or some of the riskiest parts of a mission. And Burt had actually lost a friend on the X-15, which, you know, to he wanted to develop a spaceship, really had to solve how are we going to solve this problem of re-entry. And traditionally, there's been two main forms of re-entry. One is a capsule type re-entry, very stable configuration, you know, very predictable. Still employed today, and it's a very successful model. The difficulty is you've got to land with parachutes, and you generally don't land back where you took off from. You land in the desert or somewhere remote, and you need systems to augment the landing. The alternative is a space plane, like the Space Shuttle or the X-15. The beauty of those is you have wings, so you can navigate in the airfield and you can navigate to a runway, which, you know, for us, for the versatility of wings is required for sort of a high flight operation. Mm-hmm. And I think ultimately ties us into methods for sort of point-to-point travel. And so wings are very important to us. But wings, traditionally for re-entry, you have to very accurately control the attitude of the vehicle, otherwise you risk burning up on re-entry. And so what the feather system does is take the stable, high drag characteristics of a capsule re-entry and sort of merges it with the versatility of a wing spacecraft. And so sort of the best of both worlds is sort of the architecture.
That's the phrase I was thinking of, yeah. That's Enrico Palermo of the Spaceship Company. We'll continue our tour of the Virgin Galactic Division in a minute when we'll stick our heads inside Virgin Spaceship Unity. Great photos are on this week's show page at planetary.org/radio. This is Planetary Radio.
Hello, I'm Robert Picardo, Planetary Society board member and now the host of the Society's Planetary Post video newsletter. There's a new edition every month. We've already gone behind the scenes at JPL, partied at Yuri's Night, and visited with CEO Bill Nye. We've also got the month's top headlines from around the solar system. You can sign up at planetary.org/connect. When you do, you'll be among the first to see each new show. I hope you'll join us.
Hi, Emily Lakdawalla here with big news from the Planetary Society. We're rolling out a new membership plan with great benefits and expanded levels of participation. At the Planetary Society, passionate space fans like you join forces to create missions, nurture new science and technology, advocate for space, and educate the world. Details are at planetary.org/membership. I'll see you around the solar system.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan. We're in the Mojave Desert inside a gigantic hangar called Faith. It belongs to the Spaceship Company, a division of Virgin Galactic that was founded by Burt Rutan of Scale Composites and the leader of the Virgin Group, Richard Branson. It now belongs entirely to Virgin Galactic, which is making history by building Spaceship Two there. Enrico Palermo is TSC's Executive Vice President and General Manager. We had moved just before the break from Eve, the White Knight II mothership, to VSS Unity, the second Spaceship Two. Much more of my tour and an extended sit-down conversation with Enrico are in the online version of this week's show at planetary.org/radio. Okay, here's the big question of the day. There's an open hatch there. Can I stick my head through there?
Let me check first, see what's going on. Probably can. Go ahead.
Okay, here goes. Don't mind me. We're looking inside VSS Unity now, and there is the functioning instrument panel, all glass, of course, as they say, all digital instrumentation, with three big screens and a whole bunch of other stuff that my pilot brother and others, I'm sure, would recognize. Is that instrument panel, does it have a lot in common with what you'd find in an airplane like White Knight 2?
Yeah, actually, White Knight 2 has the exact same instrument panels. They were developed for the whole system. And that's one of the beauties of White Knight 2, is in many respects, it is the airborne, it is the wind tunnel, it is the engineering test bed for spaceships. So where it makes sense, you're going to find commonality between systems of the mothership and the spaceship. So clearly there's manufacturing benefits from that, but there's also training benefits and qualification benefits. So the flight displays you see here are custom for our vehicle. But in terms of your typical, many of the features that you'd expect on a typical MFD, multifunction display, however, we have things such as energy management embedded into ours for the glide and re-entry of spaceships. So the actual symbology and what the pilot sees is customized to the flight profile.
How about the business end at the back, the rocket engine?
Yeah, you won't see it in the moment because we're starting with the captive carrier and glide flight test program. But the vehicle is powered by what we call a hybrid rocket motor, and a hybrid really is we use a liquid oxidizer in nitrous oxide and a solid fuel, essentially in a cartridge. Mm-hmm. It's a rubber-based fuel. And the beauty of the hybrid is it's very simple architecture. The only moving piece in our whole rocket propulsion system is the valve, the main valve, and it's either opened or closed. We don't throttle during flight. From a system safety design perspective, it's very simple to design that architecture. From an abort perspective, all we have to do is close that valve and we can glide to a landing at any point in the rocket profile. It's not like with a vertical launcher, you've got to ride that rocket for a certain amount of time or you've got to blast off and escape, an event. We just have to shut our motor down and the vehicle can glide back to Earth.
So in a way, again, the best of both worlds, the best of both liquid and solid rocket technology. So right now, as you said, just a big opening there. There's no rocket engine.
Yeah,
but
and the tail cone is missing as well, so we've got the tail cone currently off. Yeah.
All right, but there's going to be, hopefully before too long, another rocket engine on there. If everything goes well, how far off do you think we are from a return to powered flight?
Yeah, we're keeping our cards pretty close to our chest there, Matt, on that. And that's because, ultimately we're driven by safety. We want to be careful of putting a date out there and then being measured against it and maybe not making the right decisions programmatically. So, we want to get there certainly as quickly as we can, but the priority is to get there safely. We have the advantage that we can leverage a lot of the flight test data from the Scale program and all the expertise there to maybe accelerate our flight test program. But, this is a new vehicle and is a flight test development vehicle as well.
Beautiful paint job.
Yeah, we did an awesome job. So the silver you see on the inside of the booms, we put that there for technical reasons, and we liked it so much that we sort of wrapped it around the other side because it looks neat. So.
It is cool, yeah. With the tour complete, Enrico Palermo and I continued our conversation in a conference room. I needed to ask about the elephant in the room. On October 31st of 2014, the first Spaceship Two, Enterprise, was in the middle of a rocket-powered test flight when co-pilot error resulted in the breakup and crash of the craft. Co-pilot Michael Ausbury was killed. Pilot Peter Siebold was seriously injured. The National Transportation Safety Board determined that training and a design fault in the pilot controls were also to blame.
I was out at what was then still Rockwell, not too long after we lost the Challenger space shuttle. And I was talking with the guy who was in charge of fixing things, making things right. And what became very clear is that the space shuttle built after that time was a different vehicle. I mean, it looked the same. But there was an opportunity to do so many things that, you know, tragically the accident kind of forced them to do, but they went even beyond that. Mm-hmm. Is any of that true with VSS Unity?
What I'd say is fundamentally the concept of operations, the outer mold line, the base design hasn't changed significantly. What's changed in light of the accident? Two things have changed. Changes in light of the accident and sort of separate to that, changes in light of us having the chance to build another one. Clearly, we've made improvements to the controls with respect to the feather, making sure the thing that happened on PFF4 won't happen again. So we have a mechanical inhibit in place in respect to that. I think we've talked about that publicly to date. But we did really take a step back and look at the human interface in general and where are there other opportunities or risks that we need to protect against. I think overall we have a much more robust design as a result of the accident. So it wasn't just we tackled the issue that happened in PFF4, it just made us make sure it was, you know, we looked under every stone and saw if there's anything else we need to go address.
Thank you so much. I've had a blast. Have to make the long trip back into the city now, but I'm going to miss being in the Mojave in spite of the 80-mile-an-hour winds last night.
Yeah, safe travels. It's we've actually had a great summer here in the desert, and overnight it's got windy. That's why those windmills are here. But anyway, safe travels, and glad I could show you around.
Time for What's Up on Planetary Radio. The Director of Science and Technology for the Planetary Society joins us once again. That's Bruce Betts. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks. Good to be back.
Hey, I saw, with your warning, Venus and the Moon very close to each other last week, and I wasn't frightened because you'd prepared me.
Kind of viewed it as just a pretty thing. But yeah, I guess it could be terrifying, so I'm glad you were prepared. In the night sky, as Matt said, Venus is the super bright object, star-like object over in the west soon after sunset. There are other planets lined up with it, but they're tougher to see. If you go to Venus's lower right, there is Saturn, which is quite low to the horizon, and Venus's far to its upper left is reddish Mars. In the pre-dawn sky, we've got super bright Jupiter low in the east before dawn. Those are the easy things to check out. Apparently, it's not easy to speak, but it's easy to see. We move on to this week in space history. 1934, Planetary Society co-founder Carl Sagan was born.
Oh, that's great.
And 1971, Mariner 9 became the first Mars orbiter.
And we started to learn that Mars wasn't quite such a nasty place after all, right?
We did, at least that it had all sorts of interesting geology that we didn't know from the first flyby missions. But first, we had to wait for a global dust storm to calm down.
Those are spectacular. All right, we're ready to go on.
Random space fact. The first recorded supernova likely was recorded almost 2,000 years ago. SN 185 was recorded in 185 AD by Chinese astronomers who said a strange star appeared in what we now call the constellation Centaurus and was visible for about 8 months. Supernovas, the end state of massive stars, can outshine an entire galaxy at their peak brightness.
So I take it that we can still see something there? Is there like a cloud of gas there now or something?
They think they've found a remnant of it, yes. So they think so. It's a little dicier from the descriptions that long ago. But yes, it's
great.
Not as obvious as the Crab Nebula from SN 1054.
we're ready to go on.
We were thinking New Horizons. I asked you what science instruments on the New Horizons spacecraft have the names of characters from the TV show The Honeymooners. How'd we do, Matt?
We did well. Let me let the central character in that old classic television show provide part of the answer.
Bang! Zoom! I'm going to the moon!
That was Ralph Cramden. And just for those of you who aren't aware, he never did hit Alice. In fact, Alice was the far superior character. She was much smarter than either Ralph or his crony Norton, and usually had the upper hand and just had to put up with this guy.
But he clearly was interested in astronomy and space exploration.
Yeah, clearly, yes.
So yes, the instruments, Alice and Ralph.
It was Scott Schlieper who got chosen by random.org this time around. Scott won almost to the day 2 years ago. It was the last time he won the contest. He did say Ralph and Alice, named for the Cramdens on the 1950s television series The Honeymooners. Came back in the 60s. There was a remake, I think, in the early 2000s. And of course, the Flintstones. largely
you know,
based.
We should make a remake. I call Ralph.
Oh, no problem. I would absolutely want to be Norton. Hey, Ralphie, baby. You didn't want to shake hands with Norton. I won't explain why. We got other great entries. Hudson Ansley said, bang, zoom to the moon, Alice, which was the famous Ralph Cramden quote. He points out, though, that, of course, in this case, the moon would be Sharon. John Harrison, he never thought my dad making me watch Honeymooners reruns would come in handy someday. From Setapong in Jamaica, New York, this is the longest Honeymooner episode ever. And finally, this from Dustin Berg in Richlands, North Dakota. The distance from HN Pegasi to our solar system is about 60 years, meaning the potential residents of any Earth-like planets or otherwise in that system could be enjoying the Honeymooners right now. Scott Schlieper is going to get that prize package of a Planetary Radio t-shirt, a Planetary Society rubber asteroid, and a 200-point iTelescope.net astronomy account from that worldwide network, nonprofit network of telescopes around the world that you can use to point at stuff like the Crab Nebula or Venus, for that matter, I assume. And we're going to give away that same package again this week to whomever answers this next question from Bruce correctly and gets chosen by random.org.
All right, back to supernova. What supernova did famous astronomer Tycho Brahe observe? Go to planetary.org/radio contest.
You have until the 15th, that would be November 15 at 8 a.m. Pacific time, to get us the answer. Good luck, everybody. And good luck to you, Bruce.
And good luck to you, Norton. All right, everybody, go out there, look up the night sky, and think about why cheese comes in different colors. Thank you, and good night.
Green cheese, that's what Alice would have found, of course. That's Bruce Betts. He's the Director of Science and Technology for the Planetary Society, who joins us each week here for What's Up. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its courageous members. Danielle Gunn is our associate producer. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which was arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. I'm Matt Kaplan. Clear skies.